This is Resonance Radio. It's 2 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon, so this is Late Lunch with Outer Lunch. My name's Ben Watson. The intent of this weekly broadcast is to make heretical connections between various cultural and political zones in order to unblur, demarcate and shatter various oppressive categories of common sense thinking. This week you'll be hearing some solo saxophone from Rob Mills, as played last night at an Ease and Plastic Tuesday in the Royal College of Art, and also part two of a paper entitled Frank Zappa as Hoover, which was published in the latest issue of Circuit, the Canadian Journal of Francophone Musicology, which is published in Montreal. In order to distance myself from the paper which I'm reading, the author of Frank Zappa as Hoover has been fictionalised as Out to Lunch, rabid revolutionary aesthete and ragged flamethrower pissed, who lurks around Somerstown delivering tirades against what he sees as Parisian theoretical nonsense infecting the brains of all those who accept the division of manual from mental labour. Unlike the allegation of David Cunningham in the current issue of Radical Philosophy, Lunch doesn't assimilate Parisian nonsense entirely to Anglophone cultural studies, but instead interprets post-structuralism as the principal means by which official knowledge inoculates the revolutionary fever which sleeps beneath the tarmac of the roads of the city of Gracchus Babeuf and Charles Fourier, the Commune and Stéphane Mallarmé, André Breton, Pierre Naville and the Situationists. Indeed, so distant is Lunch from assimilating Parisian nonsense to the work of Stuart Hall and Sarah Thornton, he has elsewhere traced the rot in French philosophy to the recrudescence of idealism in Alexandre Kojève's lectures on Hegel, to Jean-Paul Sartre's amphetamine-fueled regression to Cartesian dualism in Critique of Dialectical Reason, and diagnosed the errors of Gilles Deleuze as a failure, so understandable in a nation dominated by a Stalinized Communist Party, to take on board the insights of Leon Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. So in Lunch's purview, the Francophone readers of Circuit needed to be alerted to Zappa via something other than the usual Parisian nonsense of Derrida, Deleuze and Badiou, something outré and yet crucial, ignored and yet frighteningly pertinent. So Lunch hit upon the equation Stéphane Mallarmé plus Wilhelm Reich equals Frank Zappa. This was to be the secret motor of his paper for Circuit. So imagine, if you will, out to lunch on an October morning in London earlier this week, gazing from his study window at the variegated sunlight on the trees in the parking lot in front of his flat, and pondering the material operations of the vacuum cleaner. Although he stands accused of technophobia, according to Cunningham's trendy lexicon of consumer fetishism, where laptop owners inexorably become the slavish lap dogs of Silicon Valley mastercodes, he's actually insisting that Frank Zappa's oeuvre may only be understood by being understood as a Hoover, that most ubiquitous of domestic appliances. He needs to ponder the physical actions of this mechanical beast. The uncanny thing about the vacuum cleaner, Lunch types into his ostentatiously antiquated PC, is that it's a mechanical contrivance which sucks, a basic, even primary, human impulse. It thus becomes a symbol of the strangeness of the LP and CD, pre-recorded commodities which give the appearance of life and expression, but are actually inert pieces of plastic. In commentaries to the songs on Freak Out, printed on the gatefold sleeve of Zappa's first album, Zappa shatters the illusion that a record gives the listener unmediated access to the soul of the artist. He discusses formal structure, 3-4 time, with shifts in the accents, 4-part barbershop harmony, a ballet in tableau, divorce and censorship. All considerations designed to prevent the consumer gazing at the photo of the artist on the cover and dreaming of being in love. Nevertheless, and this is what makes Frank Zappa more interesting than artists who bask in the elitist cachet of avant-garde, the song Wowie Zowie is apparently carefully designed to suck the 12-year-old listener into our camp. Freak Out sucks just like a vacuum cleaner, an ambivalent caper on the rim of the mass commodity, a situation everyone who has to work for a living and sell their labour power as a commodity is actually in. Out to Lunch pulled the ring on a can of Carlsberg Special and drank the contents in one fell swoop. He was human. He was alive. It was possible for the intellect to grasp the actuality of life under capitalism. His fingers flew over the keyboard. The suck word reappears on the back cover of Burnt Weenie Sandwich, the Mothers of Invention LP released in 1970. As usual, Zappa's use of conceptual continuity heightens what seem to be insignificant details on previous releases, back projecting a weird and spectral light. Ian Underwood prepares to sink his teeth into the corrugated rubber of a shoe sole. God, his thought bubble reads, this is a tasty little sucker. The idea of biting into something that also sucks at you encodes the dialectical aspect of lines like... That was from Idiot Bastard's Son on We're Owning It for the Money. Or the slime from the TV set, saying, you will obey me while I read you, to the TV audience on Overnight Sensation. A dialectical twist absent in the lyric sheet, but present for all to hear on the sound record. You will obey me while I read you. That was from Overnight Sensation. This dialectical understanding of action from both sides, time as a spherical constant, reached a convenient consummation in the term blowjob, a practice more logically termed sucking off. In the early 80s in the United States, the Christian right prosecuted rock bands for satanic messages they thought they could hear when spinning their records backwards. They attempted to make what they called backwards masking illegal. In response, Zappa released a track with an entire vocal track which had been mechanically reversed. On Your Hosner from Them or Us, the 1984 album, to which Them or Us the book was a compliment, Zappa's daughter Moon, parodying an exercise record, instructs, OK, like, blow and blow. Blow comes out as a new word, wolb. Of course, the retrograde, writing a tune backwards on the stave, is a standard procedure in classical music, and literate poets have always relied on reversals and mirror rings of letters. Zappa, though, with his awareness of the power relations of media, makes his use of the procedure anti-religious, rebarbative and critical. Or perhaps, comparing it with the dubious sea of cut-ups, collage and formal permutations which litter so-called avant culture, relevant would be a better word. Perhaps in the zappological future, babies will be known as wolbers. This is certainly the way Freud thought language worked, as anyone who's glanced at his essay, The Antithetical Sense of Primal Words, will be able to ascertain. Records which listen, TV sets which read you, sandwiches as tasty suckers. Zappa challenges the one-way traffic which turns us into passive consumers. He outlined his programme on the in a note on Freak Out. On a personal level, freaking out is a process whereby an individual casts off outmoded and restricting standards of thinking, dress and social etiquette in order to express creatively his relationship to his environment and the social structure as a whole. What made Zappa unique was the depth of his understanding of commodification, i.e. what capitalism does to people. In the United States, culture imported from Europe, whether classical or avant-garde, becomes a symbol of class status. This betrays the motivational principle of the avant-garde, which is resistance to capitalist social relations, or a vision of a different way of doing things. It's no accident that avant-gardes flourish in Europe only at times when social revolution threatens global capitalist interests. The 1920s and the 1960s. Are we in for another bout just now? You decide. The vulgar or adolescent aspect of Zappa, which makes aesthetes and right-on politicos squirm, is actually an attack on this snobbish appropriation of European culture by the North American elite. Zappa never lost touch with his guiding star, awareness that commercialism creates passivity, conformity and stupidity, and consumers ripe for exploitation by religion and fascism. Out to Lunch left his PC and went to the kitchen, where he found an unopened can of chicken soup. Using a screwdriver and a wooden mallet, he expertly drove two holes in the top, poured the contents into a pint glass, thus avoiding all the morsels of dead animal flesh which might impede his great work, and drank it down in one gulp, a technique learned through decades of beer drinking. Lunch returned to his keyboard and typed on, regardless of the cream of chicken soup flavour belches coming his way up the esophageal tract. The idea of nonconformist art as resistance to capitalist relations, he typed, was first put into practice by William Blake during the English Industrial Revolution, but was most cogently theorised by Stéphane Mallarmé in late 19th century France, in the Paris of the arcades and the great exhibitions, those prototypes of consumerism which we now know as the shopping mall. His essay Concerning the Book was an attack on newspaper consciousness, quite as scornful as anything Zappa says in Packard Goose, Society Pages or Turning Again. During a crisis of overproduction in the book trade, as the tables of the booksellers groaned with rubbish, Mallarmé distinguished between literary value and mere commercial exposure. He vilified the grocers and shoemakers of the book. Faced with accusations of inaccessibility because he refused to flatter readers with clichés, Mallarmé retorted that some people are so resistant to innovation they would say, "I don't understand," even if he did something as innocent as blowing his nose. Zappa used a similar image to make a similar point.
At this very moment on the stage, we have drummer A playing in 7/8, drummer B playing in 3/4, the bass playing in 3/4, the organ playing in 5/8, the tambourine playing in 3/4, and the alto sax blowing his nose.
Zappa's commentary, "Don't be bamboozled by science, some things happening up here on stage are simply ridiculous," during a version of Toads of the Short Forest played by the Mothers of Invention at The Image in Miami and included on the album Weasels Rip My Flesh. This was not the only connection to Mallarmé on that album. L'après-midi d'un faune, Mallarmé's poem from 1876, appears in the title Prelude to the Afternoon of a Sexually Aroused Gas Mask. Zappa, of course, derived the reference from hearing an LP of Debussy's famous ballet, but this was itself based on Mallarmé's text. Alchemical use of cultural signs generates patterns beyond mere intent. Lunch was getting to the nub of his argument, the hub of his cycle-wheeling history, the rub of his cockchafer, the real El Pub of his dreams. Telling Francophone academics about Mallarmé was like lecturing Germans about Hegel, a fantastic impudence on the cultural front. Lunch liked impudence almost as much as he liked impertinence. His nipples became pert cones of erectile tissue beneath his Johnny Thunders t-shirt. After his performance at Conway Hall during the Resonance Live to Air show earlier in the month, Lunch had been ticked off by Andy Pandy Wislan for using French words with a proper French accent. Andy Pandy reckoned it would piss off his proletarian followers, who thought only toffs and aristos could speak French. It was an old Anglo-Saxon prejudice stretching back to 1066. But what about the insurgent black French speakers of Guadeloupe? Sometimes Andy Pandy, resplendent as he was in his biker's leathers, could be so retrograde. Lunch decided to push his, actually somewhat limited, command of French to the Maximilien. In his essay, Poetry in Crisis, Mallarmé insisted that words mean, not the poet. L'œuvre pure implique la disparition élocutoire du poète qui cède l'initiative aux mots. All right, here's a translation. The pure work implies the disappearance of the poet as the source of rhetoric. The poet cedes the initiative to the words. This is the approach demanded by Zappa's experimental miscegenation of foreign elements. In his essay Concerning the Book, Mallarmé argued, c'est une réalité existant, par exemple, sur une feuille du papier, dans tel écrit, pas en soi. Cela qui est obscur. What is obscure is a reality, existing, for instance, on a leaf of paper, in some piece of writing or other, not in oneself, in one's interior soul. Traditional rock biography, which seeks to interpret albums by reference to the moral personality and expressive intent of the artist, can't map Zappa's wild achievements. Listen to the manifesto from Freak Out again, and ponder this statement from Mallarmé's Poetry in Crisis, whilst also recalling the moment on Uncle Meat where keyboardist Don Preston ascended to the vertiginous heights of the Royal Albert Hall and played Louie Louie on the majestic pipe organ. Note too that the Royal Albert Hall will return later in this Late Lunch Without to Lunch, another example of unwanted conceptual continuity. Zappa. On a personal level, freaking out is a process whereby an individual casts off outmoded and restricting standards of thinking, dress and social etiquette in order to express creatively his relationship to his environment and the social structure as a whole. Mallarmé. The remarkable thing is that, for the first time in the literary history of any people, superseding the great general organs of past centuries where orthodoxy is exalted like a hidden keyboard, anyone now with an individual approach and hearing can now make themselves into an instrument as soon as they blow, touch or strike it with skill. Reacting against the hidebound nature of the neoclassical or Parnassian poetry of Victor Hugo, Mallarmé anticipates the permanent revolution of modern art, where any expression is valued as long as it's not hypnotised by classical or other models. Suddenly I understand what we're doing at Easham Plastic Tuesdays. Lunch was so overtaken with enthusiasm that he was including in his talk apostrophes to the Easham Plastic Tuesdays at the Royal College of Art. Andy Pandy would chain him to the back of his bike and drag him around Red Lion Square. But since we've mentioned Easham Plastic Tuesdays, let's hear a bit from last night's performance. First of all, I'll need to insert the mini disc in the machine so that these golden moments may be shared with you. The recording begins at an upstairs window at the Royal College of Art. Down below, outside the Royal Albert Hall, throngs of fans are greeting their objects of acclaim as they roll up in limousines for the MTV Awards. Then, through the magic of subjective recording, you will be transported out of Len's office, down the stairs, and through labyrinthine passageways to the drawing studio, where you will hear Rob Mills playing his saxophone to the drawing class. The studio is situated on the Albert Hall side of the RCA building, so you'll be able to hear the sound of mass hysteria in and amongst the sounds of drawing, and Rob's incantatory bell and his saxophone. Rob Mills on sax from last night's Ease and Plastic Tuesday at the Royal College of Art. This was the kind of art which made lunch wax lyrical on the theory front. Red spatter all down the starched white bib. Mallarmé's words could serve as a manifesto for free improvisation, lunch typed, where expressive authenticity has nothing to do with the received tonality of the keyboard or academic mastery of an instrument. Witness the tabletop improvisations of Adam Bowman or the dictaphone brick stylings of THF Drenching and Sonic Pleasure, or at least demands a complete reinvention of ways of playing, see Derek Bailey and Tony Oxley. Mallarmé's words help explain Zappa's lifelong interest in characters like Wildman Fisher and the GTOs and Motorhead and Al Malkin and Lisa Popeye, people who may not have traditional musicianly skills, but who certainly have created creative relationships to the social structure as a whole. Having established the similarities, Lunch felt he should now outline the differences between Zappa and Mallarmé, differences which were threatening to dissolve in an ahistorical, anarchisto-fractal, chaotic body without organs. What distinguishes Zappa from Mallarmé is his emphasis on the sexual. Whereas Mallarmé, a good repressed 19th century schoolmaster, talked of a quelque chose d'occulte, something occult or mystical at the heart of his fascination for motifs on paper, Zappa continually compares creativity to arousal, sexual obsession, masturbation. Replacing the dancing fawn in the forest with a sexually aroused gas mask brings out something latent in Mallarmé. His fawn was dreaming of taking Venus in his arms when he had a guilty start. The text goes, "I'm holding the queen of love. Oops, certain punishment." In Mallarmé, it's not quite clear quite what anyone with an individual approach and hearing needs to blow, touch or strike with skill, avec science. It might even be themselves. Now, on a positive...
But I'm never really lonely in my eccentrifugal force.
Zappa says he's never really lonely in his eccentrifugal force. Mallarmé says, "Each soul is a melody which must be renewed. That's why the flute and viol of each of us are there." Lunch had got it. He'd proved that Stéphane Mallarmé, doyen of ultra-obscure and ascetic modernist poets, was actually a man of the people, an onanist and a militant defender of personal pleasure and satisfaction. He went on writing. Poetry is actually people finding themselves. Far from being a high priest of occult poetics, Mallarmé was actually a radical democrat. Without indulging in the pretentious name-dropping of the New York beats and punks, who, like the early Sean Bonney, preferred the individualistic histrionics of Rambo to Mallarmé's conscientious historical objectivism, Zappa understood the radical refusal of hierarchy, privilege and manipulation which drives avant-garde protests. Stéphane Mallarmé plus Wilhelm Reich equals Frank Zappa. Now, where did we put that Hoover? In 1970, Zappa made the Hoover theme explicit. The sound of Ian Underwood playing his alto sax through a wah-wah pedal on the title track of Chunga's Revenge suggested an image for a cover prose poem, illustrated inside the gatefold sleeve by Carl Schenkel. A gypsy mutant industrial vacuum cleaner dances about a mysterious nighttime campfire. Zappa's taste for variegated percussion timbres, going back to his childhood infatuation with drums and encouraged by Edgar Varese's Ionization, was reflected in the piquant image of dozens of imported castanets clutched by the horrible suction of its heavy-duty hose, waving with marginal abandon in the midnight autumn air. Percussion is not conceived as a four-square beat to which the rest of the music must conform, but as an infinitely divisible, chattering accompaniment which swarms behind the lead melody. And this is precisely the role of drummers Vinnie Colaiuta and Chad Wackerman when backing Zappa's late guitar playing. As usual, the bizarre imagery of Zappa's packaging is instantly comprehensible if you pay attention to his music. Track. reverse of one size fits all, Carl Schenkel provides a star map, every star and constellation renamed as part of Zappa's universe. Coma, Berenices and Draco have combined to form the gypsy mutant industrial vacuum cleaner from Chunga's Revenge. Coma Bernice, the plumber, is the machine's body. Drano, the suction tube. The Hoover has been redesigned to suck sewage from drains. There is nothing in the universe that Zappa's art cannot deal with. Zappa's oeuvre was indeed a Hoover, sucking in all the flotsam and detritus of mass-produced civilization. All those commodities, from imported castanets to the t-shirt racks, rubber snacks, poster rolls with matching tacks of Pufta's Froth Wyoming plans ahead on Bongo Fury, and assembling therefrom a giant junk sculpture, as Zappa put it to Gary Steele in 1990. Once a word, image or object entered what he called conceptual continuity, it immediately began to sprout extra connotations which link it to other themes. It's these semiotic tentacles which prevent the junk sculpture falling apart. This process is familiar to anyone who reads Freud on dreams and jokes. It's the way the unconscious works. So adolescent jokes about Hoovers, which naturally included their use as providers of suction relief to the ever-needful male organ, were bound to be applied to J. Edgar Hoover, especially when it was revealed after his death in 1972 that the director of the FBI and the scourge of un-American filth was a closet transvestite. The Hoover, preeminent machinery in the house of decorum, becomes sexual and ridiculous. Zappa's Shake Your Booty satirised the disco phenomenon. The track Dancing Fool was issued on vinyl 12-inch, stretched from a mere 3 minutes 43 seconds to an epic 6 minutes 15 seconds. This was achieved by the crude insertion of a galumphing funk bassline at the beginning, showing utter contempt for dance floor cool. The same bassline reappears in the middle of the song, along with some patented Zappa percussion overdubs, rather like the clap, which is the track which you just didn't hear after Chunga's Revenge. However, there's also a groaning sound, which may be a scraper or some kind of exhalation or even a vacuum cleaner, a derisory version of Donna Summer's sex noises. It's certainly the sonic equivalent of the household machine, which by sucking replicates an infantile human reaction and makes us laugh. In Joe's garage, the Catholic girls giving the crew the road crew blowjobs to save themselves the price of concert tickets are described as performing acts of Hooverism. On the same album, L. Ron Hoover of the First Church of Appliantology, a grotesque fusion of J. Edgar Hoover and L. Ron Hubbard, tells Joe that far from coming out of the closet, you must go into the closet and you will have a lot of fun. Zappa's oeuvre Hoover promises bliss, but it also locks you in a closet where the only company is the Zappologically obsessed. But since we are here, here's another coincidence concerning the vacuum cleaner. When Verve issued We're Only In It For The Money in 1967, an etching of a strange piece of Victorian machinery appeared on the cover alongside the word bizarre. Because he'd recommended Franz Kafka's short story In the Penal Colony in the sleeve notes, this apparatus seemed to picture a torture machine. In fact, it was a 19th century vacuum pump. When Zappa left Verve to form a subsidiary of Reprise, he named his new label Bizarre, and the vacuum pump became its logo, printed on each release and on each inner sleeve. His and graphic designer Carl Schenkel's intuitive juggle with Dada and pop imagery alighted on the perfect symbol for Zappa's art. In a mass-mediated commercial system which bombards us with messages and ideologies, Zappa indeed creates a vacuum, an empty space for the chance to encounter of fragments of the external world, an objective frame in which we can make our own observations and discoveries. Yet this vacuum only exists courtesy record shops, as sublime as vacuum, as banal as the Hoover commodity. It's rather like listening to a saxophone in the Royal College of Art. Thank you. Rob Mills and his rather melancholy memory of jazz, the closing notes of his two-hour performance at last night's Ease and Plastic Tuesday. After listening to this playing, Lunch felt refreshed, cleansed, polished on the inside. He felt he could address the central anxiety faced by every Zappologist. Are you in fact 3 CDs short of a bootleg? A poodle barking at the Bill Gates of dawn? Are you in fact mad? Are such observations legitimate? Lunch asked himself in print. Did Zappa mean everything in his clusters of imagery? When I interviewed him at the end of October 1993, he agreed with me that artists deal intuitively with semantic materials without anticipating every implication. His wife Gail coined a term for it. Frank invented a gypsy vacuum cleaner for the album Chunga's Revenge before having heard of the flamenco singer La Chunga. Gail calls this prescience. But did Zappa have pretensions as a psychic, or had he developed a non-materialist view of the universe? No. Indeed, if we treat Zappa himself as a source of meaning, as do the positivist no-nonsense fans, we receive the answer granted Dorothy in her visit to the land of Oz. The apparatus of revelation is but smoke and mirrors, as L. Ron Hoover of the First Church of Appliantology tells Joe in Joe's Garage. In short, meaning can only be supplied by the listener. But to continue with the Hoover theme, in January 1984, Pierre Boulez conducted 3 of Zappa's scores. When these were released later in the year, they were supplemented by pieces realised on the Synclavier, Zappa's digital music editor. Each track was conceived as a dance piece with a story and built-in sound effects. The title piece, The Perfect Stranger, was the longest of the scores, coming in at 12 minutes. It portrays a vacuum cleaner salesman attempting to interest a slovenly housewife in his wares. Zappa's story, the housewife's eyebrows going up and down as she spies the nozzle through the ruffled curtain, transforms post-Webern composition into cartoon music. As a representative of the spiritual qualities of chrome, rubber, electricity and household tidiness, the salesman sprinkles demonstration dirt on the rug before hoovering it up again. The fidgets, quandaries and rhythmic gear changes of Zappa's music Kandinsky redone in Dayglow panels and fruit machine cogs, a resolve through absurdity for which the vacuum cleaner has become an all-embracing symbol. In Value and Economy, Critique of Political Economy and the Exploitation of the Unique, the second report of the Scandinavian Institute of Comparative Vandalism, published in 1962, the Danish painter Asger Jorn argued that since World War II, the global power elite have so organised society that even they have become slaves of their own perfect apparatus, incessantly demanding novelty from hour to hour. Even the fine art the elite buy is hollow. The isms which appeared in relentless succession after the war, existentialism, abstract expressionism, pop art, op art, auto-destruct art, etc., have none of the social significance of artist-controlled movements like Cubism, Dada or Surrealism. Rather than court the attention of the public, which has rather been gathered around a number of superficial pseudoisms, Jorn said, true artists retreat into more or less closed circles. This is the hermetic resistance to commercial values inaugurated by Stefan Mallarmé. As Jorn and the Situationist showed in 1968, avant-garde artists can relate to wide social movements, but only when these challenge the hegemony of the market. The importance of Frank Zappa's Oeuvre Hoover is that he understood the difference between abnormally large sales figures and artistic value, and the chasm which separates real musical communication from pompous twaddle about greatness after the event. During his life, he held two powerful forces in remarkable tension: commercial success, plus knowledge that social recognition has nothing to do with artistic inspiration, which must make its own connections and pursue its own path. That's what gave Zappa's music its unique spike, and why Mark E. Smith of The Fall would like to emulate Zappa's combination of what he calls a resolutely uncommercial attitude with an uncanny knack of shifting units. And there's one inheritor of Zappa's legacy whose output everyone appreciates, and that's Matt Groening. Those familiar with Zappa's Hoover know how dependent The Simpsons is on his example. However, the formula necessary for a weekly show, despite the invention on display, means The Simpsons can't quite deliver the jolts of Zappa's career, where attachment to a particular musical genre was always subject to devastating attacks. Just to name a few, releasing Fillmore East June 1971 after The Mothers of Invention, which had fans explaining vaudeville from ex-Turtles about groupies. Thingfish after The Perfect Stranger, which had fans complaining politically incorrect monologues over old backing tracks. Or 200 Motels after Hot Rats, squealy avant-garde symphonies with atonal operatic sopranos, and so on. Zappa destroyed music listening as identity formation, which, according to academic studies, is the sole value pop music can confer. He replaced it with music listening as experience. The only force in quite the same league of genre savaging today, despite claims from all and sundry, has to be Eugene Shadbourne. Matt Groening supplied the artwork for one of his key albums, Country Music in the World of Islam, which turned out to be extremely prophetic. Groening and Shadbourne come from the same place, a post-Zappa culture that combines freakdom, punk and satire on American idealism. Shadbourne's Elvis is Derek Bailey, guitar supremo and founding father of free improvisation. I actually just changed that because Matt Groening always said his Elvis is Frank Zappa, and what I wrote actually was Shadbourne's Edgar Varese in Derek Bailey. I'm going to stop trying to do ad-lib changes as it nearly always sabotages the next sentence. Edgar Varese gave Zappa access to a European avant-garde tradition totally at odds with the industrial processing of blues, soul and country which constitutes American rock. Bailey freed Shadbourne from the notion that making money for a record label is the only thing which confers seriousness on a rock artist, even if it destroys the meaning of the culture which has produced you and leads to your death, as with Kurt Cobain. Shadbourne's politics, opposition to war, is consistent as Zappa's, a leftism less tainted by petty bourgeois cynicism, is expressed through adherence to a Woody Guthrie, Tom Lehrer, Phil Ochs tradition of direct address, which no one thought of mixing with free improvisation until Shadbourne did it. A genuinely innovative player, Shadbourne is the only guitarist, apart from Geoff Lee Johnson, to honour Hendrix with spontaneity, lightness and freedom, rather than metal slavishness and turgid bombast. In the 1980s, Shadbourne's band Shockabilly showed that he understood the American idea of punk, which is that of a kind of sonic onslaught. In a trio with Jimmy Carl Black, original drummer for The Mothers of Invention, and English improviser Pat Thomas, Shadbourne currently tours playing originals, Zappa, Beefheart, Dolphy, Bill Evans and the utterly unexpected, such as Slim Harpo or Black Uhuru. Shadbourne resists the way some celebrated exponents are turning free improvisation into a stagey form of art music. Instead, He uses improvisation to spike rock performance with extraordinarily musical extrapolations. Schadbourne was invited to perform at an Avant festival dedicated to John Sebastian Bach. He practiced Sonata and Partita 1 for violin on his banjo for a whole year, transposing notes which couldn't fit the banjo's restricted range, and came up with an astonishing suite of 70 minutes of music which sounds like some ethnic tradition hitherto undiscovered. All the other performers at the festival resorted to the postmodern, or is that simply facile, device of sampling and DJing old Bach LPs. It's this kind of unnecessary labour, at least from a commercial point of view, real work on the nuts and bolts of music, which makes Eugene Schadbourne's releases so strong. Like Frank Zappa, his very existence is a reproach to the candy-ass compromisers and republicans who have seized rock's media crown, or pontificate about Avant in the monthly press, or both. Here's Schadbourne, Black and Thomas playing Spanish Castle Magic by Jimi Hendrix at a girls' school in Reggio Emilia, Italy in 2001.
About a half a day to get there. You travel by my dragonfly. No, it's not in Spain, but all the same, what a groovy name. And the wind's just right. Hang on, my darling. Hang on if you wanna go. Spanish Castle Magic. Really low, they overflow with cotton candy
and battlegrounds red and brown.
But it's all in your mind. Don't waste your time on bad things. Just put that little mind down. Hang on, darling. Hang on if you wanna go.
Oh, it's a groovy name.
It's a little bit Spanish Castle Magic. Spanish Castle Magic.
Travel by my
dragonfly. No, it's not in Spain, but all the same, it's a groovy name.
And the wind's just right.
Hang on, my darling. Hang on if you wanna go.
Oh,
such a groove. Spanish Castle Magic. Spanish Castle Magic.
Eugene Schadbourne, Jimmy Carl Black and Pat Thomas playing Spanish Castle Magic by Jimi Hendrix. Schadbourne is from a different generation to Zappa. Schadbourne's teen turn-on was the Beatles, not doo-wop. Shadbourne's ethic is that of the jazz improviser rather than that of the classical composer. Nevertheless, they have in common the ability to transform musical truth into a polemical weapon versus cruddy commercialism. They both have a cartoon-fueled aversion to the gloopiness of mass-marketed emotion. The symbolic distinction between Zappa and Shadbourne is that the latter favours a garden implement, a contact-miked and super-amplified metal rake which he scrapes on a venue's walls and furnishings, causing alarm and laughter rather than a hoover. However, whether that's progress or regression, doubtless a Grove dictionary of the next century will decide. What's certain is that Zappa's legacy is only safe with those who are as brave and intelligent and entertaining as he in rejecting the embrace of the entertainment industry. Out to Lunch had finished his paper for Circuit. He ran a cold bath, filled it with lime green fruit gums and green dye, and jumped in. Eye drops filched from Esther Punk's dressing table made his eyeballs bulge like a frog's. He decided to celebrate by being a Morlock fish person for the next fortnight. That's all for this week's Late Lunch with Out to Lunch. Next Wednesday at 2, I'll be broadcasting some more music from An Ease and Plastic Tuesday. This time it'll be Len Massey's Auto Digest, plus saxophonist Rob Mills and Alan Wilkinson, a warm-up for their gig at the Spitz on the 4th of November, which will also include Noel Coxhill. Noel can't make the Ease and Plastic Tuesday because he's playing in a skip in Yorkshire. Details from www.skipping.org.uk. If any Resonance listeners would like to attend an Ease and Plastic Tuesday in person, please pass your contact details, name, phone number or street address, please, no emails, to Resonance. The phone number is 0207 836 3664. That's 0207 836 3664, and I'll get in touch with you. Whether or not you phone, please tune in to Resonance 104.4 FM next week at 2 o'clock for another edition of Late Lunch with Out to Lunch. This is goodbye from Ben Watson. Next up, it's Dan Wilson and Epistaxis time. But first of all, a commercial.